In this hour, the Civil War never ceases to fascinate, even in times when we're not having arguments about which statues that represent the war should remain in public places. Journalist Karen Abbott focused on some key women in the Civil War for a book that came out several years ago. Here's that interview from our archives. No other period in American history has generated as much study as the Civil War. It's hard not to be fascinated by the idea of our country dividing into two parts and the two parts fighting, shooting, killing each other's people, burning each other's cities. Today's guest shares the fascination, but directs it away from the usual main players. Sure, Lincoln and Davis, Grant and Lee and Moore are all mentioned in Karen Abbott's book, but she focuses on the women involved, both behind the scenes and on the front lines. Abbott's book is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen Abbott is a regular contributor to Smithsonian.com and to Disunion, the New York Times series on the Civil War. She's a journalist by training and the author of two other books, Sin in the Second City and American Rose. Karen Abbott, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
So let me talk about at the outset. We have Belle Boyd from the South, Emma Edmondson from the North, Rose O'Neill Greenhow from the South, and Elizabeth Van Loo from the North. A nice two-and-two divide here. Did you run across these women and their stories through your work on Disunion?
Actually, I first encountered them moving from Philadelphia to Atlanta, which was quite a culture shock, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. The Civil War seeps into daily life and conversation down there in a way it never does up north, nor I suspect out here. And it was just a matter of trying to get used to that. And the point was driven home for me one day when I was stuck in traffic behind a pickup truck with a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I voted for Jefferson Davis," who, of course, was the president of the Confederacy. And that just got me thinking more about the war in depth and what were the women doing? My mind always goes to what were the women doing? And not just any woman. What were the bad women doing? What were the defiant women doing? And I wanted to find four women who went beyond the usual roles of maybe darning socks and sewing uniforms and raising money for supplies. I wanted to find women who lied, cheated, stole, drank, murdered, wheedled, and flirted their way through the war. And I think those four ladies fit the bill pretty nicely.
I think you're right about the culture shock. And I don't know if people really understand this. You can still see, for example, I saw a billboard in Georgia about 1990 that was about some restaurant chain moving in from the north, and it said, "Nicer than previous northern invaders."
Yeah. It is. It's a daily joke down there, and not even a joke. I actually encountered people who refused to admit that the South lost, and other people whose daughters for school projects dressed up as these spies. So I had a little bit of inkling of these women before I really got into my research. They're sort of folk heroes down there.
You do follow two women from each side. Is that balance intentional?
Yes. I wanted to try to provide a tapestry, tell the narrative of the war in a way it hadn't been done before. And even if the women weren't interacting physically all the time, although they do, Rose and Belle do interact, and a lot of them are in the same place at the same time, their stories all connected for me in interesting ways. There was a cause and effect. One woman's behavior would affect another woman's circumstances. So it was really important for me to have those connections so that the stories flowed into one another.
Once you began to explore, though, I mean, was it a situation of having to find up to four women, or were there many you had to leave out?
Oh, there were plenty that I left on the cutting room floor that I thought were interesting, but that just didn't fit into the main narrative. And maybe a couple of them did get an honorable mention. Just to mention one of them is Pauline Cushman, who was a Union spy who worked in Louisville, Kentucky, and was captured by the Confederates and actually sentenced to be hanged, which was quite a dramatic thing for the Confederates to decide to do. And at the last minute, the Union forces swooped in and dramatically rescued her. And I really wanted to fit her in, but it just didn't work out. But there were plenty of brave women, on both sides who could have definitely have found a place in the narrative.
I sense a sequel already. The
Pauline
Cushman story. You point out that there's no invented dialogue, but you did have to imagine some situations, correct?
Well, there's no fiction, there's no invented dialogue, and no imagined situations. All of the situations that occurred, all of the events were factual. I think if you wanted to say I took any liberties, it would be when these people are in these situations. If I take a look at their actions and what they were thinking, and if it's clear in the historical record what they were thinking, and a lot of these women did keep memoirs and diaries, and so their thought process was definitely available to me. I use that. So all of it is drawn from the historical record and extrapolated from the historical record.
We start with Belle Boyd, who spied on behalf of the Confederacy. Why was she called the fastest girl in Virginia?
Belle Boyd was a really interesting character for me. She was 17 years old when the war broke out, and she was all id. You know, she had no filter. She was incredibly overt with both her sexuality and her opinions, which was really rare for a woman during that time period, especially a 17-year-old girl. I like to say that if Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th-century baby, it would have been Belle Boyd. She was really out there on all fronts. And she kicks things off in July of 1861 when Union forces are marching down Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. They had just won a small skirmish and were planning on a 4th of July celebration in Belle's hometown. And they invade her town, and they start stealing liquor and wreaking havoc and looting stores and breaking into homes. And one Union soldier threatens to raise a federal flag over Belle's home, and she shoots this fellow dead and claims self-defense and actually gets away with it. And I think Belle was really emboldened by the fact that she got away with it and decided to become a courier and spy for the rebel army.
Well, the image of his life gurgling away in Belle Boyd's garden is a profound one in the book. It's called Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. And we talked to author Karen Abbott several years ago. You'll hear more from her about Belle Boyd and Emma Edmonds and Rose O'Neill Greenhow and Elizabeth Van Loo when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange and the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Karen Abbott wrote a big book about women in the Civil War, two from the North, two from the South. Their roles in the war are told by the book's title, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. The author joined us in October 2014, and we present the interview again here. Because it is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. In the discussions of Belle Boyd, who lived in what was then Martinsburg, Virginia, it's now West Virginia, I'm struck by the quick division, how quickly people will refer to things like God hates the Yankees about people who were their countrymen just yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, there's that whole, I guess it's sort of become a cliche now of brother against brother. And the divisions were in place, I guess, before the war with the tensions heating up and really just were exacerbated after the war broke out. And you just look at people like Mary Todd Lincoln, who had about five close relatives, including brothers and stepbrothers or half-brothers in the Confederate Army. There's actually a part in the book that talks about how visitors to the White House, she had to be very wary of them pressing their ear up against Lincoln's office's door to try to eavesdrop on conversations and pass that information along. So you never knew, who was not going to be on your side. And even in the case of Elizabeth Van Loo, one of the Union spies I write about, her brother was married to an ardent Confederate sympathizer and living in the same house as all of them. So Elizabeth John, her brother, and Mary, the wife, were all living together, and Elizabeth and John had to conduct their espionage ring literally right under the nose of this sister-in-law, and it was quite a dangerous situation.
Well, there was a lot of danger for all of these women, and but Belle Boyd I want to come back to because you mentioned that she was all id with no filter. And just so one of these examples of the kind of person she was, tell us about her crashing her parents' dinner party at age 11.
Yeah, it's a great anecdote and really just give you an idea of who she was. Belle was told at the age of 11 that she was not invited to her parents' dinner party. Her parents were pretty prominent people in the town of Martinsburg and were holding a political dinner for associates, an adult dinner. And Belle was very affronted by the fact that she was not invited to this dinner and decided to saddle up her horse, whom she named Fleeter, and rode Fleeter right into the middle of the dinner party, got everybody's attention, and said, well, my horse is old enough, isn't he? and everybody just thought she was charming. I imagine that she was very charismatic, and she made me laugh every time she appeared on the page, so I'm guessing she had that same effect on people in person.
Wow, that's amazing. 11-year-old and taking your horse to the dinner party. You mentioned Elizabeth Van Loo. Now, she's a really interesting case because she lived in Richmond, Virginia, which became the Confederate capital. What made her such an oddity in Richmond?
Well, Elizabeth was a Richmond native, but she had been sent up north to Philadelphia for her education and had been under the care of an abolitionist governess. So when she returned to Richmond, she brought those ideals with her. And before the war broke out, people just thought she was kind of strange. She was a spinster living alone with her mother in this mansion on Churchill in Richmond. But after the war broke out, it was really quite dangerous for somebody to have these outspoken abolitionist opinions. And she received death threats from her neighbors. She was followed by Confederate detectives, but she nevertheless stuck to her plan to start and operate a Union espionage ring in the Confederate capital, even placing a former family slave in the Confederate White House as a spy, which I think was her greatest accomplishment.
Which is an amazing story in itself, which we had heard before, I think from Cokie Roberts' book, actually.
Yeah. There's not much known about the woman's name is Mary Jane Bowser, and unfortunately, a lot of her firsthand story had been lost to history. But there's enough to piece together to figure out some of her really remarkable accomplishments.
When we talk about Elizabeth Van Loo, though, I mean these death threats from neighbors, detectives following her, and so forth. How did she placate people? How did she let them know that maybe if she wasn't exactly one of them, she at least was the kind of person who wouldn't do them any harm, living amongst them?
Well, Elizabeth was very savvy, and she knew that her position, she was a wealthy woman. Her father had been a very well-respected businessman, and her family had owned slaves. Her father knew that to achieve any sort of social acceptance in Richmond, one had to be a slave owner. And Elizabeth sort of hid behind this proper Southern persona. And she also told people, well, you know, I'm a Christian. Of course I want to serve my enemies. The Bible tells us to serve our enemies. So when she's telling people that she wants to go visit the Union prisoners in the Richmond prisons and tend to the Union soldiers, that's her excuse. She's a good Christian woman, a good Southern woman, and this is what the Bible told her to do.
And she actually nursed a Union soldier up until his death in her home, didn't she?
She did, and it was a really risky thing for her to do. You know, it was one thing to just go to the prisons and visit the prisoners there, but to actually accept a Yankee in your home was quite another thing. And another way that Elizabeth thwarted suspicion, or tried to, was she raised the Confederate flag. She used to have a Union flag over her home, or an American flag, and she took that down when the war broke out and raised the Confederate flag, and I think that was part of her cover, too. But it was definitely a risky situation for her to tend to a dying Union soldier.
Wise move with the flag. A Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy is the book. Karen Abbott, the author here on the Jefferson Exchange. For spies in the Civil War generally, I have to believe there were some assumptions that information would travel because the battlefield is right here within the country. We're still talking about people who share a language and a lot of history. So I imagine there were some assumptions that the information was certainly there to be had fairly easily.
There was. Nobody expected women to be the ones doing this. It was unthinkable before the war began that women would be become spies like this. You know, women were victims of war, not perpetrators of war. And it was the first time, really, that people started to realize, well, women were not only capable of treasonous activity, but they were capable of executing it more deftly than men. And they actually used, their physical, their gender was both a physical and psychological disguise. Physically, they were hiding dispatches up in their hair, in their hoop skirts, in their corsets. And psychologically, if anybody accused them of treasonous behavior or of espionage, the usual response was, how dare you? How dare you accuse me of such things? It's beneath the conduct of an officer and a gentleman. I am a defenseless woman. And of course, none of them were defenseless, but they were really brilliant at exploiting society's notions of what their gender was and was not capable of.
Was there a lot of disbelief in general because of that? I mean, we're still talking about a time in history when women didn't generally get educated past a certain point in life. And so was there a lot of thinking like, well, they're just not smart enough to be able to do this?
Absolutely. Although in the case of a lot of my spies, they were fairly educated because they were coming from the higher echelons of society. But they still didn't expect women to understand politics and to have political discourse and to be able to have viable opinions on that. And I think the one exception was Rose O'Neill Greenhalgh, who was a Confederate spy living in Washington, D.C. And before the war, she had been friends with high-ranking Democratic politicians. She had even served as an advisor to President James Buchanan and was well-respected. Her intellect was well-respected among both northern and southern politicians. And I think she was the exception. And I also think that her savvy, her political savvy, aided her greatly in her spying and also her feminine wiles, considering she seduced quite a number of Union generals to get information for the rebel army.
Seduce them?
Nobody writes that explicitly. Southern women were very coy in mentioning their affairs, or if you want to call them that. But Rose O'Neill Greenhalgh did receive plenty of love letters. One of her reported paramours was Senator Henry Wilson, who was from Massachusetts. He was an abolitionist Republican and also Lincoln's chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs. So you can imagine that they had some interesting pillow talk, and some love letters reportedly from him were found in Rose's possession.
I'm still struck by the fact that there she was in Washington, D.C., but again, we forget sometimes that Washington, D.C. was still referred to well into the 20th century as a sleepy southern city by some authors, and was actually a Jim Crow city in the Jim Crow days, wasn't it?
It was, and most of the residents had, come from slave-owning families, or had come from Maryland, which, of course, was a border state with a large slave-owning population. And just the character and the mindset of the city had remained Southern. And so it was quite a shock for Rose when the Republicans and Lincoln came into power. And all of her way of life had basically vanished overnight, and she was really desperate to get her old life back and was eager to get going on her espionage ring.
There's an echo there. I want my country back. I can almost hear that coming out of her.
Exactly.
Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War is the book. Karen Abbott is the author. We've talked just about the spies thus far. I want to talk about the soldier. And by way of introduction, the name Franklin Thompson comes to the fore. But this was not a real name.
No, Frank Thompson was the alias of a woman named Edma Edmonds, who had a bit of a tragic backstory. She was Canadian and grew up with an abusive father, and he had told her he was going to arrange a marriage for her, and she did not want any part of this. She had seen what such arranged marriages had done to her sisters, and Emma wanted a life of adventure. One day she decides to cut her hair, bind her breasts, trade in her dress for a man's suit, and she begins calling herself Frank Thompson and living as a man. She migrates to the United States and starts hearing about abolitionist John Brown, who had just been executed, and the drumbeat of events leading up to the Civil War, and decided, she wanted to enlist in the Union Army. She wanted part of that adventure, and she also believed in the cause. She was an abolitionist as well.
How did she convince people, including Army doctors, for example, that she was a man?
That's a great question, and one of the first things that came to my mind. And the short answer is, the protocol is dictated that doctors conduct thorough medical examinations, but they all flouted these rules. They had quotas to fill. They needed to get the bodies out there quickly. And so they really only cared if you had fingers to pull a trigger, if you had enough teeth to rip off powder cartridges, and if you had 2 feet to march. In Emma's case, they only shook her hand and said, "What kind of living has this hand earned?" And she said it was primarily engaged in getting an education, never specifying what kind of education, but she was passed along right there and then and enlisted as Private Frank Thompson.
Her feelings about men were apparently pretty unusual for the time and quite pronounced.
They were. She considered men the enemy of her sex, and that's a direct quote. And I think a lot of that stemmed from her father's abuse. He had wanted sons and was consistently disappointed every time her mother gave birth to a woman. And she hints in her memoir that he was physically abusive. And so I think that, her earliest impressions were colored by that. But of course, these feelings change. She very unexpectedly falls in love with a fellow Union soldier and of course, has quite a conundrum. Because if her sex were discovered, she would be kicked out of the army. She might be arrested for prostitution. It was quite a situation for her. She did not know how to handle these unexpected feelings.
How long was she able to go undetected? And I'm guessing that soldiers didn't bathe much in those days, certainly not together.
Well, that's part of it too. There were several factors in place that really aided in her disguise. They would go weeks without bathing or changing. They often wore their uniforms right to bed, including their boots, because they wanted to save time to get up for roll call in the morning. They had to get up so early. The main thing, I think, was that people had no idea what a woman would look like wearing pants. People were so used to seeing women's bodies pushed and pulled into exaggerated shapes with corsets and crinolines that the very idea of a woman wearing pants, let alone an entire army uniform, was so unfathomable that even if she were right in front of you, you wouldn't recognize it. And I think that went a long way to aiding her disguise, too.
How many women do we now believe joined up on both sides? You have some further expansion of the zone outside of just Emma Edmonds.
Yeah, it was about estimated 400 women for both North and South who enlisted as men and fought. Some of them started becoming discovered in quite interesting ways. There was one female soldier, her captain threw an apple at her, and she instinctively grabbed for the hem of her apron. But of course she wasn't wearing an apron, so that gave her away. In another instance, a corporal in New Jersey gave birth while she was on picket duty. So the jig was up there. I mean, it was pretty obvious she was a woman there. But Emma would hear these stories, and of course, it would only heighten her own fear of being discovered that these things were happening to other female soldiers.
I have to believe that some women were killed in battle then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know all of the records on that, but some women were definitely killed in battle and recognized after the fact, I think, that they had served their cause. Some of the reactions were pretty surprising. The male soldiers did not, look down upon these women, but actually appreciated their sacrifice.
Did any directives ever come down on either side about, check out the people in your unit, make sure you're not hiding any women in there?
No directives came down, and I think that when generals did find out there was a woman in the ranks, a lot of them were embarrassed, and so the punishments were all over the place. There were no uniform laws in place, and hence some women just got kicked out. Some women, were arrested. Some were charged with prostitution. It really depended on the individual general and how embarrassed he was.
Karen Abbott's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Back to the spies then. I'm just trying to figure out a few things here. How did they first get set up? How does one decide that you're going to be a spy, particularly for the Confederacy, when the country has just come into existence?
Yeah, well, Rose was approached by a Confederate captain in the spring of 1861. And, of course, all of the people who were in the Confederacy, usually most of them, the large majority of them, had been, had positions in the U.S. Army or in the U.S. government. So they were already at an advantage. They already knew a lot of the secrets and the people and the politics and the personalities of the U.S. government and the U.S. Army. So this Confederate captain, who was an erstwhile Union captain or U.S. captain, approached Rose and asked her to run a Confederate espionage ring. She jumped at the chance, and he gave her a cipher to memorize. She was told to write dispatches in this certain code and send them to his alias. And if she didn't have time to encipher her dispatches, she was told to memorize the Morse code to learn the dots and dashes. And she figured out ways to convey messages using that as well. She would raise and lower her blinds according to dots and dashes and when Confederate scouts would be looking. And if she were on the street, she could achieve the same effect by fluttering her fan in a certain way. So she had quite a, it was primitive and sophisticated at the same time.
She was certainly at 17 years old when the war broke out, of marrying age. I mean, so was there a man in her life who might have noticed a few things? She was like, Rose, honey, what are you doing with the blinds,
Well, Rose was older. She was the...
I'm sorry, I was talking about Belle.
Yeah, you're thinking about Belle. Rose was actually a widow and with a young daughter, and she actually used her daughter in her espionage missions. But I think that it became fairly well known pretty early on that Rose was involved in an espionage ring. She was instrumental in the Confederates winning the first Battle of Bull Run. And after that, of course, the famous detective Alan Pinkerton gets on her case and conducts a stakeout and realizes that she might be a pretty dangerous foe.
Was Pinkerton ever successful in apprehending her?
Well,
you have to read the book, right?
Yeah. There's one of my favorite scenes in the book is when he takes two of his best detectives and goes to Rose's home on Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., and has to climb up on their shoulders to peer into her window. And what does Pinkerton see but Rose Greenhow on a sofa with a Union captain, a traitorous Union captain, and together they're looking at maps and studying fortifications, and then they start passionately kissing. And Pinkerton is enraged and declares Rose public enemy number one.
Rather for the kissing rather than the maps?
I think he was enraged at all of it. Pinkerton was, he wrote very strongly worded entry in his book about this whole scene.
You already gave us some indication of how messages moved around. Obviously, they couldn't just go down to the telegraph office. So,
right.
So this is a fairly elaborate network of ways to. You just mentioned the ciphers and the Morse code, but then the transportation itself of messages.
Yeah, and some of them came up with really ingenious ways. Belle Boyd actually used a pet dog, and I love this. She would place messages on top of the dog's back, and then she had a false dog hide, a skin, that fit precisely over the dog's back. And so the messages were on the dog's back, and she wrapped a second skin around the dog and just set the dog on through the lines along with her. Nobody, of course, suspected this dog of treasonous activity. And in Rose's case, she used 16-year-old couriers during the First Battle of Bull Run, right before the battle. She summoned a 16-year-old girl to her home, wrapped up an enciphered dispatch in this girl's hair, and told her to go on to Confederate lines and deliver this message to General Beauregard. And that she said that the Union, you know, sentries would just think she was a simple farm girl passing through the market. And the girl did just that and delivered the message, and the Confederates won the First Battle of Bull Run with Rose's information.
We'll have more on the exploits of women getting involved in the Civil War in Karen Abbott's book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Karen Abbott wrote about women operatives in the Civil War in her book Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Two from the North, two from the South, just to keep things balanced. We hear about the women and their motivations in this interview from 2014. Since it is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. I'm still curious about the spies and whether they actually received assignments or it was whether just a case of whatever they could pull in and thought was important.
It's a really good question. There were different levels of spying and different levels of espionage. There was the lowest level where, women might just stick their head out their window and count the troops passing by and report it to the headquarters. There was the second level, a little bit higher, where I would include people like Belle Boyd, who were used as couriers to deliver information and were actually charged with getting and receiving certain levels of information. And then there was the highest level, which I would include Rose Greenhow and Elizabeth Van Loo especially, where they were recruited by their respective governments and actually reimbursed and charged with delivering and receiving very important information that's vital to the armies.
Elizabeth and Rose are very interesting counterparts because they both lived in the enemy capital city, in essence, because Elizabeth lived in Richmond, was working for the North. Rose lived in Washington, D.C., and was working for the South. As much as Elizabeth tried to make sure that she was clear that she was still a good citizen of the community, it sounds like Rose was quite outspoken still about her support for the South within Washington, D.C.
Rose was, and I think it was part of her, just as Elizabeth tried to be discreet and cunning and fly under the radar, which, by the way, made her the most excellent spy, I think, that those qualities. Rose, I think, used her brazenness as part of her own disguise. She had a young daughter, as I had mentioned earlier, and I think she figured, well, what are they going to do to me? I am a widow, I'm the mother of a young daughter, and the North knows that if they persecute me, they're just going to turn me into a Confederate martyr, and she was right in that respect. The North North was really fearful of how Europe would view the whole thing. Europe was already thinking that the North was a bit barbaric, especially with the Union blockade, which was causing Southern civilians to starve, in effect. And they were really trying to tread a fine line with how they treated Southerners and Southerner prisoners of war. And the last thing they wanted to do was persecute a widow and a mother of a young girl and make Rose Greenhow a Confederate martyr. And Rose played that to the hilt.
So there was all, you know, there could be a list. Look what they're doing to me.
Exactly. And she did. She would send letters to papers that were reprinted across the country in which she directly attacked Northern officials, William Seward and Lincoln. And she was, you know, did not hold back any words.
So give us some sense of American history up to this point. And again, the country's not even 100 years old by this point. The centennial, obviously, in 1876. What had happened in wars previous to this one? I mean, were women ever this outspoken before? I mean, they're really out front and center on this.
Yeah, you know, of course there was espionage, and women were part of espionage rings during the Revolutionary War. That was that whole Culper ring. But they were not outspoken about it. And I think this is the first time that women really made it known that they had political allegiances, that they were going to speak about them, and that they were willing to put their lives on the line in a way that they hadn't before, and in greater numbers. So I think that was the big difference, just the number of women and the volume with which they voiced their loyalties and what they were doing. You know, Bell and Rose were very outspoken about their allegiances. And I think, you know, in Bell's case, that also worked as a disguise. And she would flirt with soldiers and say, well, how dangerous can I really be? I'm telling you I'm a Confederate spy. I'm telling you I'm working for the Confederacy. But really, if I'm telling you this, how dangerous can I possibly be? And it was sort of disarming.
Or sort of a little old me. How could I possibly be a danger to you?
Exactly.
Wow. But compare that then to the outspokenness that men could get away with in similar situations. I mean, if there were a man in Richmond who talked about supporting the North, or a man in Washington talking about supporting the South, what would they have gotten, a beating or something?
Well, there were the first spy executed since Nathaniel Hale in the Revolutionary War was a Union spy named Timothy Webster, and he was in Richmond, Virginia, and he was one of Alan Pinkerton's men. And it was really interesting to me how all of that developed. Pinkerton, for all of his savvy, was really sort of stumbled in the way that he conducted his espionage early on in the war. He would send people down to Richmond to try to infiltrate the government, but never gave a thought to the Union loyalists who were already living in Richmond, who already knew the people there, who already had access and connections. And so of course, they were more brutal with men. But men employed also many of the same disguises as women did. There was one of my favorite spies. It was a fellow by the name of Benjamin Stringfellow, who was blonde hair, blue-eyed, 94 pounds, and according to one comrade, had a waist like a woman's. And he would dress in elaborate ball gowns and call himself Sally Martin and go to Union military balls and dance with partners and try to get information about Ulysses S. Grant from his dance partners. So just goes to show you that the women weren't the only ones cross-dressing during the war. You know, the men were in on that action, too.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Did Benjamin get his own section in the book?
Mention. I found it really fascinating, the disguises that some employed. You know, people feigned epileptic fits, and they feigned stuttering, and somebody had to remove his glass eye, and, you know, they even dressed as slaves. They disguised themselves as slaves, darkening their skin with silver nitrate or burnt cork, which, of course, presented a problem if they either started sweating or if it began raining and their skin began to run.
Right, or brushed up against something. It's like, you left a bit of your skin color on my
exactly.
shirt there,
fella. Which actually happens in the book, so...
I understand that there was some debate within the U.S. government about what to do with the fashionable women spies.
Yeah, and that was one of my favorite quotes. You know, it did draw upon the fact that these women used their fashion, they used their clothing in their espionage, and that they were you know, very clever about that. And it was something that the United States government hadn't expected. Pinkerton, you know, tried to remind people that these were dangerous women. Rose Greenhow, you know, contributed to the Confederate victory, the shocking Confederate victory at Bull Run, and at the same time, Rose goes on trial and people are downgrading her offenses. There's one scene where she asks for her papers back, and she's shocked when one of her prosecutors says, Well, I don't think it'll be a big problem to return your papers to you. After all, we don't think you were intent on anything more than mischief. And Rose, you know, is offended by this mischief. You know, you're downgrading my contributions as, you know, to mischief. So even when there's ample evidence that these women were, you know, actively working against the government and capable of causing damage, they still weren't taken all that seriously.
So, you know, here again, then, their gender was getting them taken more lightly.
Exactly. And they, and you know, it, at the same time that it was, I'm sure, frustrating for them on many levels, it was a protection for them.
Belle Boyd in particular sounds like she came into physical danger at least once. And you mentioned some circumstances in which she would you know, do the whole how could I be a threat to you thing. Just look at me. I'm a little slip of a thing. Were there other circumstances where things got a bit more serious for her?
Well, there was, I think, her greatest act of espionage. And, of course, it's ironic for Belle and typical for Belle that her greatest act of espionage was the most visible one. Of course, it was performed for all the world to see. She was not a very secretive spy. But it was during the Spring Valley campaign in 1862 when General Stonewall Jackson was marching in the valley and there was going to be a battle at Front Royal. And Belle got information by listening to a war council. She actually literally placed her ear to the floor and overheard information from a Union war council and knew that the only way Stonewall Jackson was going to get this information was if she charged out into the battlefield and delivered it to him herself, which she did, dodging bullets, you know, putting herself at great risk and found Stonewall Jackson. And I think part of that was because she had an obsession, a sort of unhealthy romantic crush on Stonewall Jackson.
Ever requited, or was it nothing they were ever able to act upon?
Well, Stonewall was a very odd man. Belle, you know, she told everybody that she wanted to, quote, occupy his tent and share his dangers. if I were Stonewall Jackson, I think that would frighten me more than anything the Union Army had in store, the fact that Belle Boyd wanted to share my tent. But it was unrequited. I don't think Stonewall Jackson knew quite how to think about her, as many people did not.
Were these women, the women in the spying efforts, Belle Boyd, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, Elizabeth Van Loo, were they able to get fairly close to major figures, or did it even particularly matter? Did they need to just get to somebody who knew enough about troop movements and gun emplacements and things like that?
Well, Elizabeth in particular had sources all placed throughout the Confederate Army. She had a great family inheritance and bribed knew how to bribe people and knew who to go to bribe. And she had high-ranking sources in the Confederate Army, and she also eventually connected with Ulysses S. Grant. She became Ulysses S. Grant's main and most important spy. And I think it's fair to say that Elizabeth Van Loo was the most important spy, male, female, north, south, in the entire Civil War.
Partly due to her, the presence of, was it her slave who was living at the Davis Mansion?
It was. Her family had owned slaves, and Elizabeth, after her father passed, decided to free all of the family slaves. And she also began spending her inheritance buying slaves for the express purpose of freeing them. And she really had a special fondness for one young slave, Mary Jane Bowser, and she freed her when she was a young girl. And so, you know, she sent her to be educated. And when the war broke out and Verena Davis, who was the first lady of the Confederacy, announced that she needed help, Elizabeth had an idea. So she pays Verena Davis a social call and says, "Well, I hear you need help. I have a girl for you. She's not very bright, and she stumbles in the kitchen, but she'll serve your purposes." And so Elizabeth sends over Mary Jane Bowser. And nobody knows that Mary Jane Bowser is not only literate, but highly educated and gifted with a photographic memory. So while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk and cleaning up the children's toys, she's also sneaking peeks at maps and fortifications and overhearing his confidential conversations with advisors and reporting all of this back to Elizabeth.
And do we have reason to believe that that might have made some difference in some major battles in the course of the war?
Absolutely. Mary Jane Bowser was an invaluable source for Elizabeth to have. I mean, here's somebody who's, you know, literally in the heat of the Confederate heart, you know, the heart of the Confederacy and in the house that's deciding all of its moves. And they devised a really interesting system whereby Mary Jane Bowser would sew dispatches into Verena Davis's gowns, into the hem of her gowns, and deliver them to a seamstress who was in on the whole thing, who was a Union sympathizing seamstress, and the seamstress for a family friend of Elizabeth. And Elizabeth would go pick up these dresses at the seamstress and get the dispatches, and the dresses would be returned to Verena Davis with nobody being the wiser.
Did Elizabeth enjoy the same sort of out in the open protection that Rose O'Neill Greenhow enjoyed, where she would become a northern martyr if she were dealt with? And did anybody track her like Pinkerton did with Rose?
Well, it's a good question. The Confederate detectives were on her constantly. They were always searching her home. Elizabeth had to be very careful about that. She became quite paranoid, would check underneath her bed, would turn around and see a detective at her window. She was constantly fearing that she was being entrapped on the street. If people would come up to her and say, "I'm with the Union, I have, if you want me to go through the lines, I'm going to go, give me some information." And she had to devise ways to learn who was really on her side. They had tokens that only real members of her espionage ring had. They wore these certain pendants that only the certain members had. And if they were turned a certain way, it was safe to talk. And if they were turned the other way, it was not. So she had to be really careful about that. She did not have the same protection. I think that she was fearful of her life every day.
Of the four women that you profile here, again, Belle Boyd, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, Elizabeth Van Loo, all spies, Emma Edmonds, who posed as Frank Thompson, in the Union Army, all very fascinating. Any one in particular that really catches your eye and your heart more than the others?
Well, I like them all for different reasons. As I mentioned, Belle Boyd was comic relief for me. I laughed every time she was on the page. I really enjoyed Emma Edmonds. I can't imagine the strength it took for somebody to pull off being disguised as a man for that long and living in close quarters and being on the front lines of battle. I mean, she's somebody who operate as a nurse and operate as a courier and was on the front lines, witnessed many deaths, held dying men in her arms as they died. And yet there was a vulnerability, a constant fear that her whole way of life that she constructed for herself very carefully and meticulously was going to end. And it was heartbreaking. I thought she was particularly heartbreaking.
I should point out, the book is divided into five parts, one for each year, 1861 through 1865. So obviously the details get a bit grimmer as the book goes on, which is really part of the issue. I mean, as much as it is a fun read, the fact is this was deadly serious work and not with good results, obviously, for hundreds of thousands of people.
Absolutely, and I think that that really shows, especially with Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who later on in the war gets sent as an emissary to Europe to lobby on behalf of the Confederacy, which was an unprecedented move and quite a testament to how highly the Confederacy thought of her. And she had this great European diary that she kept and that was never published. It's in the North Carolina archives, and she just records her feelings, and you can just see her the depression growing and the grim certainty that they were going to lose was showing up every day and the struggle she had with that.
An amazing set of women and an amazing account of them in Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Karen Abbott, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.